From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll speak with sports writer Frank DeFord. As a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, he covers the entire American sports scene, from spectacles like the Super Bowl to the solitude of a putting green at sunrise. Also today, I'll talk with writer Jane Smiley. Her novella, The Age of Grief, probes the heartaches that accompany middle age. Folk singer Garnett Rogers will play a song that sets to music a poem by an Australian writer. And critic Ken Tucker will review the new home video of The Invisible Man, the 1933 classic starring Claude Rains. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is sports writer Frank DeFord. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, having joined the magazine in 1962, right out of college. His specialty is the long feature in the back of the issue. His subjects have included the upbringing of tennis star Jimmy Connors, the debut of jockey Steve Coffin, and pitcher Jim Boughton's comeback attempts. Since 1980, DeFord has been a regular commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He also does commentaries for NBC Television. He was voted Sports Writer of the Year four times by the National Association of Sportscasters and Sports Writers. In 1983, he wrote a very personal book about his daughter Alex's losing battle with cystic fibrosis. The made-for-TV movie adaptation of Alex, The Life of a Child, was recently rebroadcast. Frank DeFord's new book is a collection of what he considers his best pieces from Sports Illustrated. It's titled The World's Tallest Midget, and it's just been published by Little Brown. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to be here.
The title of your new book is a reference to how constantly disparaged sports writers are. You want to explain?
Yes, I think that generally we are put down. I said in the introduction that it's an odd thing, but the genre of sports writing, most people assume the worst of it. The worst of sports writing is taken as representative. And I said in there that anybody who wants to be a good sports writer is usually viewed as wanting to be the world's tallest midget, and that from thence came the title.
Which came first for you, your interest in writing or your interest in sports?
I think my interest in sports, like any kid, was always there, but my interest in writing certainly superseded my interest in being a sports writer, if I can put it in that order. I wanted to be a writer and ended up as a sports writer without ever intending to be one.
You've been working for Sports Illustrated basically since you got out of college.
Yes.
And in there you've been able to do long pieces. Did you ever do the kind of daily journalism that sports writers for newspapers do?
No, and I think that's probably the reason that I've stayed in it. I don't think that I could have been a sports writer for long if I had had that kind of burden on my shoulder. I don't think I could have even covered... When I first came to the magazine, I covered a lot of sports and did deadline stories. I was really wearing of that after 4 or 5 years. And I think I've been lucky, number one, that Sports Illustrated has given me the vehicle to do the kind of stories that I really like. And number two, that sports itself has kind of exploded. And the kind of stories I do, I don't think I could have done them 20 or 35 years ago or 40 years ago because they just sort of weren't accepted then. You were supposed to write little sort of John R. Tunis hero worship stories, and sports people were not supposed to be written about seriously. So I'm very lucky in that regard.
What didn't you like about the idea of daily journalism or of deadline journalism? You get tired of describing one game after another?
Yeah, I don't think I'd have been good at it no matter what I was writing. It isn't so much that I wouldn't have been a good deadline sports writer. I would not have been a good deadline writer. I guess we're all hybrids in this business, and I think I'm more of a writer than I am a reporter. And ultimately, I think that would have won out, and that's really the reason. It isn't the subject matter so much as the pressure of that.
You said that the sport you most dislike writing about is football. Is that because of the people who play it, or is it something intrinsic to the sport?
It's more of the difficulty of writing about the sport. And it's my theory, and I think this is fairly obvious, this isn't like I'm coming in from left field, it's that the hardest sports to write about are those that involve the most people. I mean, that's simply a dramatic verity. football has these thousands of people, like Mongol hordes, that play in games, and it's very, very hard to focus in and get the drama of it. I said in the book that it's a little bit like nobody writes very well about the House of Representatives either, and that's for the same reason. And what sports writers write best about, the good ones, are about individual sports. I think maybe the one exception to that rule may be baseball. In baseball, you've got the pitcher versus the batter, which is kind of an individual confrontation within the context of a team game, which is maybe what makes baseball such the preeminent intelligence sport that it is. But football, what football lends itself to then is because you can't write about the people very well, then football writers invariably write about the strategy and the X's and the O's and that interminable nonsense that goes on. And football is really the worst written sport of all.
Well, you do a lot of almost psychological profiles of people. You go into their past, their relationships, how their relationships bear on the game that they play and the way they play it. The cliche way of thinking would be that would be harder to do in football because football players would be less reflective. I don't know if there's any truth in that or not.
Are football players less reflective? I don't know if they are. I think they're less liable to talk. They may be reflective, but I think it remains within them. Again, if I can keep this stereotype going, I think that somebody who plays football wants, in effect, to get lost in the crowd. Whereas whether you're playing tennis or ice skating, I think you're more likely to be kind of an extroverted person and a loner and liable to reflect out loud. Football players are not, as we say, very verbal. I think that would be the difference, though, of course, there's all kinds of exceptions to these rules.
Does doing long pieces as opposed to daily beat journalism get you out of the obligatory locker room interviews where you ask someone about the game, after the game, they say, great game and got a great ball club?
The other thing that drove me out of locker room interviews was being in the locker room, where most of the time you're interviewing somebody without any clothes on. And that's very disconcerting. And people used to say, well, that's all that the women want to do, the women sports fighters, is get in there into the locker room with a bunch of nude men. Well, let me assure you that whatever the gender involved, it ain't worth it. It is a very, very discombobulating situation. And I'm always amazed, though, at these athletes who can sit there buck naked, kind of toweling themselves off and carrying on a relatively normal conversation with 20 people with their clothes on. It kind of amazes me. But it's really not the sort of situation for good dialogue. And that drove me out as fast as anything else.
Is it the kind of thing where you want to stare and know that you shouldn't?
It's hard not to. I mean, it's not a normal situation. I've said in the past that you can have some good conversations when everybody has their clothes on, and you can have some good conversations when everybody has their clothes off, but it's this sort of halvesies element that makes it very difficult to concentrate on the questions.
I always have the feeling you never really get much anyways when you do the locker room interviews.
You
get cliches and...
It's you're really getting the surface stuff. What did you throw? Well, it was a curve. He had a curveball. I really got hold of that. We didn't mean to call that play. I checked off at the line. You get those sort of things. It's very rare that you get any kind of thought. And you certainly don't get to the bottom of people under those circumstances. And again, we get back to the fact that I'm just really not interested in that kind of deadline journalism in the first place, whether it's in the locker room or the parking lot or on the bus or wherever.
Sports writer Frank DeFord is my guest, and there's a new collection of his pieces called The World's Tallest Midget. You've been writing since 1962, and you say that you came in on the cusp between the period in sports writing when sports writers were really two-fisted drinkers and now when they'll indulge in an occasional glass of wine. Yeah. What happened to change sports writing?
I think it's what happened to change the world. I think that there've been that kind of evolution everywhere, and I think this too. One of the reasons that sports writing is not as bad as it's portrayed is that it hasn't kept up with its reputation. We have much better, more intelligent people writing now. I think that in the old days, there was a tendency to get sort of the leftover element for sports writing. If you couldn't do anything else, you were sent out to cover the football game. Or if you were just kind of a cheerleader, you were sent out to cover the football game. There was an awful lot of people who got into sports writing simply because they couldn't play and weren't smart enough to coach and didn't know how to bandage people, so they couldn't be trainers. So by process of elimination, they became sports writers. And we do have a much brighter group of people around now, thank the Lord, and much better writers.
You know, I'm surprised you keep talking about sports writers' bad reputation, because it always seems to me that everybody says the best writing in the newspaper can be found on the sports pages, and there's been so much praise lately of sports writing.
Well, I think most people think of sports writers as Oscar Madison. I mean, nobody deals in stereotypes better than Neil Simon, and that was the classic, The Odd Couple, that stereotype. But there has been as well that cliche that you suggested there, where the best writing is found on the sports pages. And I'll buy that. That's probably been true for a long time in a lot of papers. But the companion cliche to that, which was also very true, like most cliches are, is that the worst writing was also found on the sports page. So that you did usually have one good writer per newspaper. Who had a certain amount of intelligence and rhythm and was able to write, and he was surrounded by the dregs, simplifying it. But, yeah, that was true. I think you've got to remember about sports writing is what a neat thing to write about sports. You got everything there. You got the drama. You have very obvious characters. You have wins and losses. You have people who, by and large, are pretty expressive. And they're fun, and they're young, and they're still innocent enough to tell you things, and so forth. And so it's pretty hard to screw it up if you've got any talent whatsoever. I mean, imagine, I think sometimes, of being like a political writer. Or have you ever written about entertainment figures where you are they're practically put in one of those bubbles, surrounded by publicity people, and they will only speak to you when it serves their purpose, and so forth. You compare sports to that, and it's an entirely different world. It's in a way, it's kind of surprising we haven't had more talented sports writers, because the subject matter is so darn good.
You've alluded to how in your profession of sports writing, years ago there was a lot of under-the-table bribing that promoters would smear someone in order to get a good story written in. Had that stopped by the time that you started writing?
The only kind of bribes I ever got early on were suggestions that if I wanted a woman for the night, they were available.
Really?
That was early on. I don't think I've had one of those in the last 20 years. Maybe I'm just getting old.
But who would offer it?
Oh, you'd come into town to do a story on X team, and the general manager would say, "Everything okay? Can I?" You know, it was pretty obvious. But I think by that time, the situation had begun to change. What you used to get was, like, if you were the boxing writer in X town, it was understood that you were going to be on the take. Part of that was that all journalists, and not just sports writers, were so badly paid that it was almost understood that they were going to get money on the side. You had an awful lot of kind of quasi-bribes, which continued, I think, probably into the 1970s, where the sports writer covering the local basketball team would also write articles for the program and get paid for that, and probably get paid out of context. And so there was a little bit of that that went on too. People doubled up. And again, I think that began to fade when you got, number one, when journalists got better paid, and number two, when a little more honorable group came in. Dick Young, who's often vilified, writing then for many, now for the New York Post and now for the New York News, earlier for the New York News, when he took over the job as the beat writer for the news for the Brooklyn Dodgers, he went and told the news he wasn't going to take the job unless the news started picking up his tab. Before that, the ball club would pick up the tab. Now, that was in New York for a major newspaper.
So you're beholden to them.
Yeah, you were absolutely. They paid your travel. They paid your hotel. And then you were supposed to turn around and write critically or just objectively. And that sort of system, thank the Lord, has finally gone out.
Well, I think more than any other writer in a newspaper or in a magazine, that sports writers are expected to be fans and cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to have a home team and cheer for them and so on. Is that still the case?
Oh, that's the hardest thing. That's another reason I don't think I could have been a beat writer, because that's a very hard thing to do. You travel with a team. You live with the team. In the old days, of course, on trains, they practically literally lived together and played cards and ate breakfast together. And then you're supposed to be as objective as you possibly can day in and day out. And it is a very difficult thing to do for even the most superhuman kind of journalist. But it's also true that the fans expect you to be the cheerleader. And this applies most of all, Terry, in small communities. The smaller the community, in other words, the guy who writes football for Alabama, oh boy, he's got a harder job than the guy who covers the New York Yankees, even though it's the same principle.
Because they're fiercely loyal.
They're fiercely loyal, and you are considered to be a traitor. The letters of General Sherman that have been uncovered and are out now, his views on the press in the Civil War, approximate what most fans and certainly what most athletic directors and coaches feel about the press in those kind of parochial situations.
So you're kind of free of that in a national setting.
Oh, national, you're fine. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I've come into cities sometimes, and the local beat writer has said, hey, look, I want to tell you that the tight end and the quarterback hate each other's guts, and the so-and-so and the assistant. And I said, gee, that's fat. I haven't read that anymore. He says, I can't use it. So there are limits even that you have to put on yourself. And as a national writer, you are above that.
Sportswriter Frank DeFord is my guest. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Sports writer Frank DeFord is my guest. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and a regular commentator on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He has a new book that's a collection of Sports Illustrated pieces. It's titled The World's Tallest Midget. You've described British sports writing as being the strongest influence on your writing. I'll confess that I've never read any British sports writing, so I'm not sure how it would influence
you. You've read British writing, and it's probably not a whole lot different than the rest of the British school. Basically, British writers, and I was astonished to find this out when I was in my 20s and first experience, they write about games more as reviews, as theater reviews. American writers are horribly literal, and they're also the worst, is they're so dependent on quotes. You can't say somebody played a good game or a bad game. You've got to go down and get the manager to say that. And the British writers, often, though I'm afraid they're being inducted into the American school, often they wouldn't even go to press conferences. They didn't want to hear some guy say he played well. That was what their job was to describe that. And I was very taken by that when I first saw it. And on top of all that, of course, British writers are a whole lot more literate and care a lot more for the language than American writers. And so that kind of made me feel good, because that was the way I wanted to write. And I saw it there, and it was lovely. And it has had an impact on me. There's no question about that.
It's an interesting comparison, sports writer to art critic or drama critic.
Yeah, because I've often said that soccer, for example, the absolutely dullest game in the world to watch. It's a wonderful exercise, and I don't want to argue that point. But it is so dull to watch, and how many goals will be scored in a game? It's usually 1-0 or 1-1 tie, or 0-0, as they say. And yet the British could write about it beautifully, because among other things, the action and the goals didn't get in the way. It was like seeing a ballet, and that's the way they wrote about it. Or cricket, which is another dull sport to watch. I would much rather read a British cricket story or a British soccer story, none of which much I understand, than an American football story.
Let's talk about a couple of pieces that you did. You have a piece in your new book that's a profile of tennis player Jimmy Connors, and it's a piece about his background. It's almost a psychological profile, too. It's a lot about his relationship with his mother when he was growing up and as an adult. And you write after the piece, in a little postscript, that he wouldn't even talk to the press after the piece was published. What made him so angry about it?
I think it was revealing. I think it was terribly revealing. I think that pulled away a layer that Jimmy had kept around himself. He had just been sort of the kid so to speak, and a pugnacious kid. And what I wrote about, as a matter of fact, the piece is called Raised by Women to Conquer Men. And it was his mother and his grandmother, who he called Two Mom. He was so close to her, T-W-O, Two Mom, that made Jimmy the tough kid that he was and gave him all his competitive juices. And I think Jimmy was a little reluctant to let people know that women had been so important to him. I think that he was a little scared about that. But even beyond that, it was just simply, I don't think we like to be unmasked. And he was very taken back by it. Subsequently, I learned that his mother, anyway, though she initially disliked the piece, I was told by friends that she had come to accept it as a very true and not altogether unflattering article.
Did that hurt your access to other athletes thinking, well, you know, he might write something about me, he might reveal something about me that I won't want written?
That's funny, Terry. I've never had that. I think I do have a reputation of being fairly fair and balanced. And so I think that's the main thing to have. And then I have had people, after I wrote an article on Bear Bryant, for example, I wanted to do an article on Coach Dean Smith at the University of North Carolina. And he told me, because he didn't like the Bear Bryant article, and he was generally mad at the press, that I could not interview him. But that's the exception to the rule. I think most athletes will accept you, most not only athletes, but other people as well, will accept you if they think you're fair. If they think you're a poison pen or a hatchet, then you're in a lot of trouble.
You know, I was thinking, I've heard a lot of your sports commentaries on Morning Edition, and really enjoyed them, and I might not have known about your work if it wasn't for that. And I'm thinking that you probably get exposed to a lot of people who don't follow sports that closely through broadcast commentaries. And that also made me think about how, in a lot of ways, sports is still a pretty male world. And I wonder how much that has changed. I know that there are women journalists breaking in some places there are women athletes breaking in, but for the major league type teams that you cover, they're male,
it's still
period.
Pretty much a male province. First of all, what you say about National Public Radio, this is sort of family talk, but it is interesting beyond that, because so many people, and in this particularly women, say just what you said, that I never heard of you before, and I don't care much about sports, but I've listened to you for years on National Public Radio. There's no question that it's an altogether different audience for me, and I try to treat it that way. And sadly for me, I think what else you said is correct, that sports remains very, very much, and sports journalism particularly, a male province. And I've talked to some female sports writers who've simply left because it wasn't worth the fight, the aggravation, day-to-day, you know, the bamboo shoots under the fingernails. Every time you go into the locker room, somebody is going to say something. Every second or third week, somebody is just going to bar the door for 30 seconds just to make it unpleasant, you know, that sort of thing. And after a while, you say to yourself, I don't need this. And the funny thing is, I think that if I were a sports editor, I would go out of my way to hire women writers if I possibly could, not because I'm a nice guy, but because if I wanted somebody to interview a 25-year-old young athlete, male, it stands to reason that he might open up to a young woman more than a young man. And so I think we're missing a real bet, just from a vocational point of view. I think we ought to try harder to get women into the field because, they should. I mean, to turn it around, I think I've done some of my best stories with female athletes because I think there's, you know, I've always said that interviewing is like a high school date. It really is in many respects.
You really think so?
Particularly, not just.
I don't think of it that way.
Oh, well, you see, but you're talking about radio interviewing,
right,
which is
right.
What you do. And the kind of interviewing I do is usually done alone, often, in a den or in a cocktail lounge even, or over dinner, whatever. It's like a date. And the subject is trying to impress, the interviewer, and put on the best possible face. I mean, you do everything but bring somebody a corsage. and I play a very, I think there's a certain amount of flirting that goes on. You play a role. I do. I'm the first to admit this. If I'm with somebody who's raucous and loud, I tend to put on that kind of, the leopard changes his spots. If somebody is quiet and wants to go to church, hey, I'll go to church. And so there's an awful lot of that, and that's why I think it's really more natural in many respects to have the opposite sex interviewing each other. Whether it's a male interviewing a female or a female interviewing a male doesn't really make a whole lot of difference.
You know, in continuing with this male-female thing, I wonder if when you're traveling on the road with a largely male group of sports writers accompanying mm-hmm. male teams with male administrations running them, if there's this sense of behavior of, well, the ladies aren't here, so now we can really behave in the way that men behave together.
You know, there's a... I just did a piece for Sports Illustrated about a month ago, a very unpleasant piece on Green Bay, Wisconsin, where three of the athletes have been involved in, everything from rape down to harassment in a bar. And some of the things I read suggested to me that possibly this is because when you're in this all-male environment all the time, it's much easier to, in the cliche term, look upon women as objects. And I think that what you're saying obtains there. I don't think there's any question. I quite understand why women don't want to be sports writers. To put up with this kind of environment, it's just you say, I don't need it. I'd rather go and do something where I've got a chance.
Has feminism penetrated into sports at all in the consciousness of the people who play it or run it, do you think?
I still think it's probably less there than it is anywhere else. I'm still berated by male tennis players for my interest in women's tennis. I'm considered,
really?
It's clearly that I'm considered a sissy. They say, well, you know, we could kill them. I mean, but that's not the point. It's like saying that the heavyweight champion can beat up the lightweight champ. But you do get this. I read something in the paper today that there was a suspicion that the NCAA wants to cut funds and so forth. And really what they're trying to do when push comes to shove, it's going to be to take funds away from women's sports.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so let me ask you this quickly. A lot of people have used sports writing as a stepping stone to something else. Now, you've written screenplays, you've written novels, but you're still writing about sports. Do you want to keep writing about sports no matter what else you do in your writing?
No, I don't feel that way at all. I would give a very sort of wishy-washy answer and say I'll keep doing it as long as it keeps coming, but I would walk away tomorrow if that's where the cards were dealt.
That's interesting. Well, Frank DeFord, it's really been interesting to have you here, and I want to thank you very much for joining us.
I enjoyed it, Terry.
Sports writer Frank DeFord was my guest. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. His collection of pieces is titled The World's Tallest Midget. It's published by Little Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with novelist Toni Morrison, so I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I'll speak with writer Jane Smiley. Her new novella, The Age of Grief, is about the disappointments and loss that mark the passage through middle age. Folk singer Garnett Rogers will sing a poem that he set to music by Australian writer Henry Lawson. And critic Ken Tucker will review the 1933 film classic The Invisible Man, starring Claude Rains. It's now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Canadian folk singer Garnett Rogers joins us today for our weekly performance spot. He started playing professionally back in the 70s with his brother, the late Stan Rogers. A couple of years ago, through fellow folk singer Priscilla Herdman, Rogers was introduced to the work of turn-of-the-century Australian writer Henry Lawson. Like Herdman, Rogers decided to set some of Lawson's words to music, and he's going to perform one of those songs for us.
Over the past year, I've begun increasingly fascinated with the writing of an Australian poet, a man named Henry Lawson. He was born in 1867, died in 1922, and during his lifetime was sort of the poet laureate of Australia and established a whole new school of writing. In spite of all that, he died basically penniless and alone, a hopeless alcoholic. I think a fitting role model for any aspiring folk singer. And throughout his lifetime, his poetry wasn't really accepted that well by the critics. They found it mostly sort of overly sentimental and mawkish and a little bit too Rudyard Kipling-ish. And for the most part, they were right. It is rather overly sentimental. But what happens with these rather uncomfortable and mawkish poems if you take them off the printed page and set music to them, they become wonderful folk songs, and I don't really know what that says about folk music as a genre. Anyway, this is one of his that I set to music. It's called The Slip Rail and the Spur. And a couple of words of explanation might be in order here. A slip rail, in this case, is a kind of a primitive gate used for keeping cattle. and a spur is not what you wear on your cowboy boot. It's a small mountain. And the song basically deals with how incredibly stupid men can be in terms of their relationships with women. The colors of the setting sun withdrew across the western land. He raised the slip rails one by one and shot them home with trembling hand. Her brown hands clung, her face grew pale, a quivering chin and eyes that brim. One quick, fierce kiss across the rail, then goodbye, Mary, goodbye, Jim. Oh, he rides hard to race the pain, who rides from love, who rides from home. But he rides slowly back again, whose heart has learnt to love and roam. One hand upon the horse's mane, one foot in the stirrup set, and then stooping back to kiss again, with goodbye, Mary, don't you fret. When I return, he laughed for her, we do not know how soon 'twill be. I'll whistle as I round the spur, you let the slip rails down for me. She gasped for sudden loss of hope, as with a backward wave to her, he cantered down the grassy slope, swiftly round the darkening spur. Oh, he rides hard to race the pain, who rides from love, who rides from home. But he rides slowly back again, whose heart has learnt to love and roam. And so often at the set of sun, in winter bleak or summer brown, she'd steal across the little run and shyly let the slip rails down. And she'd listen there until darkness shut the nearest spur in silence deep. And when they'd call her from the hut, steal home and cry herself to sleep. Oh, he rides hard to race the pain, who rides from love, who rides from home. But he rides slowly back again, whose heart has learnt to love and roam. And he rides hard to dull the pain, who rides from one that loves him best. And he rides never back again, whose restless heart must rove for rest.
Garnet Rogers' latest album, The Outside Track, is on the Snow Goose label. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Jane Smiley. Her new book, The Age of Grief, is a collection of short stories and a novella. Most of the stories deal in some way with marriage and family. In reviewing the collection in the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani wrote that in the title piece, The Age of Grief, Smiley sets down for us the affectionate, ironic banter that can help bind a couple together, as well as those terrible, skewed communications in which everyday words conceal a darker subtext. Familiar moments are captured by Miss Smiley with such immediacy and precision that we are left with a sense of having participated in her characters' lives. The Age of Grief is Jane Smiley's first novella. It's a form few writers choose nowadays.
I thought about this a lot because I was really interested in the fact that I was writing a novella, and that was a new form for me. And I finally decided that what you could do with a novella was to explore a single character or a single subject almost completely. And also, it seemed to me at the time that you could be more meditative in a novella and more contemplative, because a story doesn't seem to be able to stand up to much meditation simply because the weight of too much meditation unbalances the action. And so the novella seems to me to be a kind of a sort of reflective length.
Well, your novella, The Age of Grief, is certainly very meditative. There's not a lot of action in it, but there's a lot of reflection and a lot of observation.
In some ways, I think that a reader of a novel wouldn't have the patience to go on in that meditative way, to be at page 10 and to say, look at all this meditation here, and then look at these 400 pages I have left to go. How can I stand this? But if he says, look at, I only have these 80 pages left to go, well, I can take it.
You make it sound like a real trial, but it's really not.
Well, I think any writer who, I won't say any writer, but I feel a little apprehensive when I fall into meditative writing in my work, just because it comes natural to me, and I always feel like I'm tempting the reader to lose patience and to skip looking for when the next killing comes, you know. And so I guess that's why I think of it in those terms.
I'd like to ask you to read a passage from the novella The Age of Grief, and this is actually the passage in which the title is kind of explained. Would you read that for us?
Sure.
We should mention here, this is a man talking. This is the character whose voice you're reading now is a husband and father and dentist and the main character of the novel.
I am 35 years old, and it seems to me that I have arrived at the age of grief. Others arrive there sooner. Almost no one arrives much later. I don't think it is years themselves or the disintegration of the body. Most of our bodies are better taken care of and better looking than ever. What it is what we know now that in spite of ourselves we have stopped to think about it. It is not only that we know that love ends, children are stolen, parents die feeling that their lives have been meaningless. It is not only that by this time a lot of acquaintances and friends have died and all the others are getting ready to sooner or later. It is more that the barriers between the circumstances of oneself and of the rest of the world have broken down after all. After all that schooling, all that care. Lord, if it be thy will, let this cup pass from me. But when you are 33 or 35, the cup must come around, cannot pass from you, and it is the same cup of pain that every mortal drinks from.
What made you think about the mid-30s as being an age of grief?
Well, there are a number of things. Once my mother and I were driving, and we actually were on our way back from visiting my therapist, which put my mother in a meditative mood. And she started reminiscing about her 30s and how hard they had been. And, you know, I look around me and I see that nearly everybody I know, I'm 38 now, but almost 38, but when I wrote this, I was 35. Nearly everybody I know is coming to terms with some of the decisions that they made 15 or 20 years ago. I mean, at the very least, a lot of people are coming to terms with years of substance abuse, like drinking or smoking marijuana or something, or they're coming to terms with years of being married to a person that maybe they married for the wrong reasons. I think for my generation, in some ways, we had this belief that we were protected from a lot of things, that if we just got into the right schools or got the right jobs or did things in the right way, using the right techniques, that somehow we would evade mortality or at least the obstacles that other people seem not to be able to evade. And yet nobody can evade them. They are there, and you run right into them. And I think your 30s is when you start to do it.
What happened in your 30s that made you think in these terms?
My marriage fell apart. And I had two children, and I could see that the marriage, the breaking up of the marriage, however much it was positive for me, was incredibly destructive to them. And that, in turn, of course, was incredibly painful for me. So all of the feelings were more profoundly mixed than I ever thought was possible. It was like you couldn't turn in any direction and have it be a positive direction.
Well, you actually made your main character a man in the novella. And I wonder why you did that, since you seem to feel very personally some of the feelings that you wanted to communicate in the novel. Why'd you make him a man?
Well, when my marriage was breaking up, it seemed to me that I could see things from my former husband's point of view with crystal clarity, maybe for the first time. And because maybe it was for the first time, that was a much more compelling point of view to my imagination than my own point of view.
What could you see from his point of view that you weren't able to see before?
Maybe the fragility of the family, and he is a very involved father, and he was extremely present in our home, and somehow that was very compelling to me, that our marriage was ending, and it wasn't just me who was breaking up the home, but I was breaking up his home too. And I think every writer wants to portray the thing which is the most interesting to her. And for me at the time, for whatever reasons of denial or whatever neurosis, his point of view was more interesting to me at the time. So it never occurred to me not to to tell it from his point of view.
When you started writing, and I don't know how old you were when you knew you wanted to write, did you feel like you had anything to say, or did it take a while till you knew what your subject matter was as a writer?
Well, I've never felt like I had anything to say. For me, writing is a kind of way of discovering the world rather than a way of expressing myself. And so when I wrote a novel when I was in college, and what I consciously wanted to do in the novel was to find out about a situation that intrigued me. And that's really what's been propelling me all along. If there's something I'm interested in, I always think, well, let's write about it and see. And I think that's an act of imagining the thing so that it can be assimilated.
So writing is almost an investigative process for you.
Yeah, I think it is, really.
Okay, well, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jane Smiley's new book is called The Age of Grief. She spoke to us from WOI in Ames, Iowa. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
More coverage of the Pope's visit coming up?
Yes, we'll have several stories. And the news today is that in Miami, Pope John Paul II met with Jewish leaders, and that meeting was described all around as productive. Also, we look ahead to the Pope's stop this weekend in San Antonio, Texas. I spoke with Mother Angel, who is the Mother Superior of a Carmelite order there. Her 11 nuns have just finished baking the 300,000 communal wafers that will be offered for the papal mass in San Antonio this Sunday. We also have education on All Things Considered tonight, four stories, among them a convention of newly literate people meeting in Philadelphia.
Okay, well, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director James Whale made The Invisible Man in between two of his other 1930s horror films, Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein. The Invisible Man was based on a story by H.G. Wells and featured Claude Rains in his first starring role. This scary classic is now available on home video cassette. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of it and of some other current video horror fare.
The scariest movie I ever saw as a child was the 1933 version of The Invisible Man starring Claude Rains. I never saw it in a movie theater. I watched it on TV, on the Million Dollar Movie in New York. And at about age 10, I had what we would now call an out-of-body experience when Claude Rains unwrapped the white bandages around his head to reveal nothing but air. I think my parents had to pour my brains back into my trembling little body. You may be sure, therefore, that when I heard that The Invisible Man was being issued on video cassette, I couldn't wait to see whether I could reproduce this awful experience now in my dotage. This is the point at which I'm supposed to say wistfully that it just wasn't the same, that you can't go home again, horrifically speaking. But I'll be darned if I didn't get a chill when Claude Rains felt around for where his nose should be. This time around, I realized that what's so frightening is the great romantic tragedy of the situation— that Claude Rains, as the obsessed, egotistical Dr. Jack Griffin, is doomed to be cut off from all human contact as an invisible man. Here, Griffin is talking to his former sweetheart and inadvertently reveals that his invisibility has also turned him into a raving lunatic.
There is a way back, Laura, and then I shall come to you. I shall offer my secret to the world with all its terrible power. The nations of the world will bid for it, thousands, millions. The nation that wins my secret can sweep the world with invisible armies.
Jack, I want you to let my father help you. You know how clever he is. He'll work with you day and night until you find that second secret, the one that'll bring you back to us. Then we'll have those lovely, peaceful days again, out under the trees, after your work in the evening.
Your father? Clever? You think he can help me? He's got the brain of a tapeworm, a maggot, beside mine. Don't you see what it means? Power. Power to rule. To make the world grovel at my feet.
Jack, listen to me.
Horror films these days tend to be pretty bloody affairs. When people complain about the violence, they're not just being squeamish. But it's a terrible mistake to dismiss all modern horror films as trash. Recent video cassette releases that have stretches of artful terror and flashes of wit include From Beyond, director Stuart Gordon's 1986 tale of possessed souls. There's also Nightmare on Elm Street 3, one of the very few modern horror series to have spawned a monster you can watch again and again, Freddy Krueger, who has knives for fingernails and wears his face inside out. In my worst dreams, some filmmaker is out there even now making a new movie, Freddy Meets the Invisible Man. As Count Floyd used to say on SCTV, "Hoo boy, that's scary."
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Thank you.
Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with Adam Hochschild, founder of the leftist magazine Mother Jones. He's written a memoir about his ambivalent relationship with his father, a staunch capitalist who owned a string of diamond and gold mines in South Africa. Also, we'll introduce our new jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, who will review a new album featuring clarinetist Bill Easley. And TV critic David Bianculli will look at the shows that are sneaking into the schedule before the official start of the fall season. So I hope you can join us, and we'd like to hear from you. Write us at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller, who directed today's show. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.